Foundation. And he, in fact, like Professors Ulrich and Jastrom, had the honor of having Frank Moore Cross as his doctor father in Harvard. However, it's only with Professor Jastrom that he shares the more exalted biographical datum of having, of being an alumnus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne with a concentration in exegetical theology. He is also fulfilling that highest of callings, the teaching of Torah, although as opposed to Professor Jastrom, in Dr. Meyer's case, still with that ritual purity of Qumran, of which we spoke yesterday, as opposed to the later Talmudic approach. And we should mention his bibliographical data, his book, Asherah, the Extra-Biblical Evidence, and his articles in the Anchor Bible Dictionary. So Dr. Walter Meyer III.
Well, thank you, Professor Judish. There's a handout coming to you, and I'll be explaining this handout. On the first page, in the left-hand margin, about halfway down, you may see the words W-O, parts of man. It should be two parts of man. The copying machine cut off the T there, so he could supply that. That'll make sense to you. Since the first publications of Qumran scrolls, scholars have noticed a theme of dualism in many of these manuscripts. In certain passages, for example, light is contrasted with darkness, truth with error, the righteous with the wicked. With regard to this theme in the Qumran literature, the most famous passage undoubtedly is the one known as the Two Spirits passage. It is column 3, line 13 through column 4, line 26 of the scroll entitled The Community Rule or The Order of the Community, a translation of the Hebrew phrase Serek HaYachad. The manuscript is also known as the Manual of Discipline. Since the manuscript was discovered in Qumran Cave 1, it is abbreviated as 1QS. And of course, then the S being taken from the first letter of the title, Serek HaYachad, transliterated. The scroll itself is dated to 100 to 75 BC. However, since this preserved manuscript apparently is not the autographed copy, the actual composition of the community rule probably dates to the end of the second century BC. Not all scholars are agreed on how to regard the passage, column 3, line 13, through column 4, line 26, in comparison with the rest of the community rule. Some propose that 313 to 426 had a separate prehistory and was added later to the community rule. Whether or not such was the case cannot be ascertained. What is certain is that our passage is an integral portion of the preserved manuscript 1QS, which consists of 11 columns, and I side with the many scholars who regard 313 to 426 as an important part of the doctrine of the community rule. Fragments of 10 manuscripts of the community rule found in K4, 4QS A through J, do not indicate otherwise. Preben Wernberg-Moller, in his 1961 Review to Qumran article, A Reconsideration of the Two Spirits in the Rule of the Community, is an example of scholars who interpret 313 to 426 by considering parallels in the context of the community rule and vice versa. Further, there are scholars who propose that 313 to 426, particularly with its doctrine of the two spirits, is not typical of Qumran theology, but rather should be seen as an aberration or as an unusual passage. After reading through the published Dead Sea manuscripts, I find this proposal unwarranted, despite the fact that our passage has certain unique or rare phrases compared with the other Qumran literature. I agree with those scholars who understand 313 to 426 to be the most thorough formulation in the scrolls of the Qumran doctrine of spirits. A.R.C. Leaney, who lists parallels between 313 to 426 of the community rule and other Qumran manuscripts, correctly states, A fair summary seems to be that in 1 QS 313 to 426, the doctrine of spirits is not isolated, but that a strong concentration of it is to be found here. Even though its teaching is not unique in the scrolls, it may be the original statement, or close to the original statement, which inspired the other passages like it. Also, there is no scholarly consensus concerning how to understand the spirits mentioned in 313 to 426. Are they expressions for cosmic principles, or are they dispositions or temperaments in man, or are they something else? The purpose of this paper is to offer an interpretation of ruach, spirit, as the word, whether singular or plural, occurs in 313 to 426. Going hand in hand with the matter of interpretation will be a comparison of the uses of ruach in our passage with pertinent portions of the New Testament. Finally, relevant passages from the Old Testament, which perhaps served as sources for the teaching in 313 to 426, will be considered. Such recourse to the Old Testament is justified and necessary, since the published Dead Sea Scrolls give ample evidence that the members of the Qumran community regarded the Hebrew Bible, or Old Testament, as their sacred book and source of doctrine. Therefore, one need not, indeed should not, speak about an Iranian / Persian Zoroastrian background, as some scholars have, for the two-spirit doctrine of 313 to 426. They defend their position by pointing out that the Jews, especially those living in Babylonia, had numerous and lengthy contacts with the Persians during the time of the Persian Empire and after. These contacts, they argue, could have resulted in Zoroastrian teachings infiltrating certain Jewish circles, perhaps first in Babylonia, but eventually also in Palestine. Having made this point, they proceed to affirm that the dualism seen in the Qumran manuscripts, and specifically the two-spirit doctrine of 313 to 426, is a modified form of elements of Iranian cosmic dualism. Zoroastrianism, they explain, presents man's situation in the world as caught in the conflict of two spiritual forces, Ahura Mazda, source of good, light, and truth, and Angra Mainyu, source of evil, darkness, and falsehood. However, the thesis of Zoroastrian influence on Judaism in general, and on the Qumran community in particular, lacks decisive evidence and remains highly questionable. Edwin Yamauchi, in his book Persia and the Bible, has demonstrated a number of problems with this thesis, including the fact that our major sources for Zoroastrian theology are extremely late texts, dating to the 9th century AD. James Barr suggests that arguments for Iranian influence upon Judaism rest on the selective presentation of similar elements and the ignoring of the structural reasons why these similar elements are important within one religion as distinct from another. Concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls, he concludes, "The facts of the texts make it seem unlikely that Iranian metaphysical dualism is being reproduced here. Taking the question as a whole, with openness towards either possibility, one is inclined to conclude that the dualism of the two spirits at Qumran, with the accompanying paraphernalia of light and darkness, truth and iniquity, could have evolved from inner Jewish developments." Again, this paper holds to the position that the Hebrew Bible, or Old Testament, served as the background for Qumran doctrine, including the teaching in 1 QS 313 through 426. With these introductory comments having been made, we proceed now into an interpretation of the occurrence of Ruach, spirit, in our passage, with brief textual comments. For the most part, I am in agreement with the work of Arthur Secchi, who in his superb monograph, The Meaning of Ruach at Qumran, shows that this word in the Dead Sea Scrolls has various meanings according to context. God's spirit, man's spirit, angel or demon, wind and breath. The translation we'll be using is mainly my own, based on the photographs of John Trevor, so that I could refer to crucial portions of the text with certainty. Where I felt comfortable using a published translation, I did so. Lines column 4, 3b through 14 on the handout are from Michael Nibb's book, The Qumran Community. After checking Nibb's translation with the photograph of column 4 of the scroll, I made minor additions to his text, which are in brackets. In putting together this handout, I also consulted the translations of Miller, Burroughs, and Geza Vermesh. Ruach appears 16 times in our passage, but is implied several other times. The first occurrence is in column 3, line 14, all the kinds of their spirits. Spirits here refers to men's spirits, judging from the suffix their. More precisely, the words all the kinds of indicate that the whole phrase, all the kinds of their spirits, is talking about the variety of spiritual dispositions found among human beings. Seki, who has done an exegetical study of Ruach in our passage on the basis of the use of Ruach in the rest of the non-biblical Hebrew literature of Qumran, has the same understanding of spirits in line 14. He gives as one reason for this interpretation the fact that the whole passage, 3:13 to 4:26, ultimately envisions a wide variation of spirituality among men. The next occurrences of Ruach are in lines 18 and 18 to 19, two spirits, the spirits of truth and perversity. Clearly, the two spirits are equivalent to the spirits of truth and perversity. Both phrases refer to the spirits of men and not to angelic powers external to man. Seki, of the same understanding, states that the key evidence for this interpretation is the feminine gender of Ruach in both instances, that gender being clear from modifying elements in the sentence. He has observed that Ruach, meaning angel or demon, in the published non-biblical Hebrew scrolls of Qumran, usually occurs in the plural and most often in a masculine form, although various forms of the feminine plural are also frequent. The outstanding characteristic of Ruach as angel or demon, however, is its consistently masculine gender, indicated by related elements in the context, no matter what form it might have. Concerning the two instances of Ruach in lines 18 and 19 of our passage, Seki concludes, if the author had wished to indicate personal angelic beings with Rukoth in these verses, he almost certainly would have used the masculine gender, as is customary everywhere in the sectarian Hebrew scrolls in talking about angels. As it is, he used the feminine gender, which is almost always used in the sectarian scrolls in reference to man's spirit. Yet the spirits of lines 18 and 19 are not exactly the same as the spirits in line 14. In line 14, they were all kinds of spirits. In line 18, the two spirits. The distinction is this. Spirits in line 14 refers to a variety of spiritual dispositions, whereas the word spirits in lines 18 and 19 refers to what the author believes are the two parts of every human being, a good part and a bad part. Dispositions, as we shall see, can range from a person being very good to a person being very bad. The combination of the two spirits in a person and their proportions, or ratio, so to speak, result in what kind of disposition he has. In line 24, the phrase, all the spirits of his lot, which could be rendered all his allotted spirits, refers to the devil's evil angels. That spirits here means demons is clear from the context. In line 25, the spirits of light and darkness, two in number, as indicated by the following lines, are to be identified with the two spirits of 3:18 to 19, the spirits of truth and error. As Seki explains, the feminine gender of Ruach in 3:18 to 19 and 3:25 indicates that spirits in both places refers not to angels, but to the spirits of men. Specifically, the two spirits of light and darkness in line 25 are the two parts of every human being, as we concluded, with regard to the two spirits of truth and error in lines 18 to 19. In column 4, line 3, the phrase spirit of humility occurs. This refers to man's spirit and, precisely speaking, a spiritual disposition. According to the context, spirit of humility is part of a series of expressions, all referring to human qualities, which, in turn, are said to describe the ways of the two spirits, 4:2. Though the ways of the two spirits are referred to in line 2, a spirit of humility, patience, abundant compassion, etc., should be understood as the way of the spirit of truth or light. In other words, the good part of a man, the spirit of truth, induces or works for a spirit or disposition that is humble, patient, very compassionate, etc. A spirit of knowledge in line 4, part of the same series of expressions as spirit of humility in line 3, likewise is a good spiritual disposition resulting from the spirit of truth. The phrase counsels of the spirit occurs in 4:6. Seki has observed that one way of referring to God's spirit in the other published non-biblical Hebrew scrolls of Qumran is by having the singular of Ruach without qualifying expressions, which is the situation in line 6. Concerning the meaning of Ruach here, he makes essentially 3 points. A, that the unqualified Ruach in itself refers to God's spirit. B, that in 4:6, the author of 1 QS 313 to 426 wanted to redefine Ruach, unqualified, as the spirit of truth, from 3, column 3, lines 18 to 19. And C, that this understanding of Ruach in line 6 as referring to the spirit of truth was probably held only by the author of our passage and by none or very few of the other members of the Qumran community. Yet how the other Qumran sectaries understood Ruach in line 6 cannot be determined. Likewise, whether or not the author of our passage was attempting to redefine unqualified singular Ruach remains uncertain. When a word appears without qualifiers, we must rely on context for interpretation. Here I do agree with Seki's point that the author used Ruach in line 6 to refer to the spirit of truth, namely the good portion in a person. This is the most natural interpretation according to the context. In line 9, the author will begin to describe the spirit of perversity, the counterpart of the spirit of truth. We also note that the full phrase, the counsels of the spirit for the sons of truth, perhaps is evidence for our understanding of Ruach in line 6. Moving to column 4, line 9, the phrase, the spirit of perversity is a spirit of man. Seki notes that the non-angelic nature of the spirit is reflected in its feminine gender, as in column 3, lines 18 to 19, and 25. Further, he explains that the pattern seen in line 9, Ruach in the singular, followed by a genitive indicating a quality, in Qumran's sectarian Hebrew literature is the most frequent means of referring to a spirit of man. Clearly, spirit of perversity in line 9 refers back to the spirit of perversity mentioned in column 3, 18 to 19. Thus, 4:9 speaks about the evil part of a person, which, as the following lines indicate, induces greed, slackness, etc. Spirit of lust in line 10, appearing in a list of evil human qualities, is a spiritual disposition. The spirit of perversity mentioned in line 9 brings about a spirit of lust, just as the spirit of truth produces a spirit of humility and knowledge, back in lines 3 and 4. The phrase, all spirit of perversity, appears in line 20. As in column 3, 18 to 19, and column 4, line 9, so spirit of perversity here also refers to the bad portion of men and not to an evil angel. Also, the context just preceding, lines 15 to 16, and following, lines 23 through 25, these lines immediately preceding and following our phrase in line 20, points to this understanding. Seki mentions once again that the pattern seen here, the singular of Ruach, with a genitive indicating a quality, is the most frequently used pattern in the non-biblical Hebrew scrolls for describing a spirit of man. Does spirit of holiness in column 4, line 21, refer to the spirit of God, whom we call the Holy Spirit? Seki answers in the affirmative, giving among his reasons the following 2. There is no unambiguous use of the singular of Ruach in the scrolls in construct with any form of Kodesh in the singular, which means anything other than God's Spirit, whereas this basic pattern is often clearly used to refer to God's Spirit. And then a second reason. The Ruach Kodesh of our passages cleanses, tahar, man from sin of a moral nature, and this kind of cleansing is never attributed in the sectarian literature to man or man's spirit, but is always the work of God or his Spirit. However, in his first reason, Seki implies that there are at least ambiguous uses where Ruach, singular, in construct with Kodesh, could mean something other than God's Spirit. Indeed, examples exist where Ruach with Kodesh perhaps should be interpreted as the spirit of man, and one will follow shortly. Concerning Seki's second reason, column 4, line 20 does not exactly say that the spirit of holiness cleanses man from wickedness, but rather that God cleanses man by or through the spirit of holiness. There is a preceding passage in the order of the community, column 3, lines 6 through 8, which is a partial parallel to column 4, line 21. The same preposition, the Hebrew bait, is used with ruach. I use the translation of nib. For it is through a spirit of true counsel with regard to the ways of man that all his iniquities shall be wiped out, so that he may look on the light of life. And Seki regards this spirit as a spirit of man. Continuing with Nib's translation. It is through a holy spirit uniting him to his truth that he shall be purified from all his iniquities. Seki regards this spirit as God's spirit. It is through a spirit of uprightness and humility that his sin shall be wiped out. And Seki regards this spirit once again as a spirit of man. Whether or not spirit in this passage means disposition or the good part of man, these lines state that a man is cleansed by his good spirit, which actually comes from God. Therefore, because of the context which both precedes and follows 4:21, I think the most natural interpretation of the spirit of holiness is to understand the phrase as a spirit of man, and I see no decisive reason against this interpretation. Precisely speaking, the spirit of holiness is the good part of a man. The phrase is equivalent to the spirit of truth and the spirit of life encountered earlier in our passage. In fact, the phrase spirit of holiness in line 21a is paralleled by the phrase spirit of truth in line 21b. This parallelism apparently giving us the proper understanding of spirit of holiness. Seki himself admits that the author of our passage, with this parallelism, wanted his readers to understand spirit of holiness as equivalent to spirit of truth. However, Seki proposes that the author here was attempting to redefine the phrase spirit of holiness, which Seki holds traditionally was understood as spirit of God, but Seki's proposal is debatable. Spirit of truth in 4:21b, as already indicated, is the good part of man. In line 22, the phrase spirit of impurity is equivalent to the spirit of perversity in line 20, thus meaning the bad part of man. All of the preceding context leads us to understand the phrase spirits of truth and perversity in line 23 as the two parts of man, one good, the other bad. The main argument against this interpretation is the masculine gender of the verb struggle, yarivu, which, as Seki argues, suggests that spirits in line 23 means angels. As Seki points out, however, our scroll 1QS seems to prefer the masculine to the feminine in the imperfect plural, whether or not the subject is masculine in gender. In column 4, line 18, the imperfect plural verb they walk is masculine, yith halakhu, even though the subject is feminine. Further, three suffixes in lines 25 and 26, translated them, their, and them respectively, refer back to the antecedent in line 23, the spirits of truth and perversity. These three suffixes are feminine, and this evidence would seem to outweigh the questionable evidence of the masculine verb. Thus, there is no decisive evidence against seeing spirits in line 23 as the two parts of man. Again, the whole context of 3:13 to 4:26 supports such an understanding. Finally, in line 26, the phrase his spirit obviously means a human spirit, and being singular leads us to the understanding disposition. Line 24 describes man as having both a good part and bad part, implying that according to the proportions of each part, so was the disposition of a man. Verse 26 seems to be concluding that the judgment of a man at the time of God's visitation will be based on which part, the good or the bad, is dominant. That is, on what kind of spiritual disposition or spirit a man has. Thus, spirit in line 26 is a nice inclusio for our passage, which began back in 3:14 by mentioning all the kinds of spirits or spiritual dispositions. Having presented my understanding of the various occurrences of spirit or spirits in our passage, I want to comment briefly on certain aspects of the doctrine of 3:13 to 4:26. As we have seen, this treatise teaches that man has two spirits, that is, a good part and a bad part. These two spirits, the spirits of truth and perversity, or light and darkness, have been appointed, indeed created, by God. Column 3, lines 17 to 19. Column 3, 25 reads, "And he, God, it is who created the spirits of light and darkness." Also column 4, 26. "These two spirits abhor each other." Column 4, 17 to 18. The text also says that God has established them in equal parts. Column 4, lines 16 and 25. The Hebrew expression used, bath, bavath, occurs in Exodus 30, 34. In our passage, the phrase apparently is not to be interpreted in its literal sense. Rather, the phrase indicates that both spirits make their mark in this age, although the description of this age in portions of our treatise and in other Qumran scrolls makes clear that the spirit of perversity was thought to be dominant. Additionally, the phrase "in equal parts" carries the thought that both spirits will be warring constantly against each other in this age, with neither wiping out the other. Again, our passage states that each person has both spirits. These two spirits struggle in the hearts of men, so that each person to a certain extent walks in both wisdom and foolishness. The proportions of the two spirits in people vary from person to person, to the extent that a person is made up of the spirit of truth, to that extent he does good, and to the extent that he is made up of the spirit of perversity, to that extent he does evil. One example here from 4, 24 to 25. "And according to the inheritance of a man in truth, he does right, and so he hates perversity. And according to his possession in the lot of perversity, he does wickedly, and so he abhors truth." Another Qumran text, 4Q186, teaches the same concept of various ratios of the spirit of truth and perversity from person to person. Three men are described by giving their precise share of light and darkness. One man is very bad, 8 parts of darkness and 1 of light. Another is mainly good, 6 parts of light and 3 of darkness. The third is almost perfect, 8 parts of light and 1 of darkness. Depending on the ratio of the good parts and the bad parts in a person, that is, according to his inheritance in the spirit of truth and the spirit of perversity, so is a person's spiritual disposition. He is either predominantly good or predominantly bad. But within each of these two broad categories, there is a spectrum, with people in the first ranging from good to very good to excellent, and in the second from bad to very bad to atrocious. Thus, it can be said that there are a variety of spiritual dispositions. Again, the beginning of our passage. The good part of a man, the spirit of truth, produces all sorts of good fruit, which are described in 4:2-6. The bad part of a man, the spirit of perversity, produces all sorts of bad fruit, which are described in 4:9-11. Again, according to our passage, God has predestined people to do good and bad works. This is column 3, lines 15-16. Probably this implies that the proportion of the good part to the bad part in a person has been predestined by God. We note the use of the word inheritance in column 4, lines 15, 16, and 24. According to the inheritance of a man in the spirit of truth and the spirit of perversity, so are his works. Now, Our passage's teaching about the two spirits reminds us, of course, of the New Testament doctrine of the flesh, the unregenerate portion of a man, to which our passage's spirit of perversity would be compared, and the spirit, the regenerate portion, to which the spirit of truth in our passage may be likened. The statements in 3:13 to 4:26, though, do not harmonize completely with New Testament doctrine. For example, the New Testament nowhere teaches that God created the flesh, the equivalent of our text's spirit of perversity. Also, according to New Testament doctrine, not all people have flesh and spirit, but only the believer. The unbeliever is totally unregenerate. The author of 3:13 to 4:26 taught that all had both the spirit of truth and the spirit of perversity in varying proportions, probably based on his observations of himself and of his fellow human beings. No one was perfect, but no one, he decided, was completely wicked. Even the very bad had, for example, some moments of civil righteousness or of kindness to others. A third difference between the teaching of our Qumran treatise and that of the New Testament is that the New Testament does not talk about proportions, how much a believer is flesh and how much he is spirit. A fourth difference, the New Testament teaching that the believer's spirit is in union with Christ and has the power to overcome the flesh is absent from our passage. A fifth difference is this. The New Testament does not teach that God has predestined some to be ungodly, and he has not predestined evil works. Nevertheless, all believers this side of the grave do have an evil part, the flesh, and a good part, the spirit. The flesh and the spirit do, according to the New Testament, abhor each other. They do war against one another within the Christian. We think of Paul's classic description of such a battle in Romans 7. As our passage in 1QS, the New Testament, too, uses the word spirit, not only for the good part of a person, precisely speaking of a believer, but also to designate a person with his inner spiritual nature or character, that is, his spiritual disposition. There are two general categories of dispositions, godly and ungodly. And we find this in 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 to 6. John's use of the word spirit there, and compare that later on. This last phrase we see in John 4, 1 to 6, the spirit of truth and perversity, is very similar to our phrase in our Qumran passage, but it is used in a different way there by the apostle to indicate spiritual disposition. Further, the New Testament teaches that those with a godly disposition, namely believers, vary in their producing fruit for the Lord. With spiritual growth and maturity, the believer will exercise more and more his spirit in union with Christ, resulting in an increase in good works. Paul reams out the Corinthians for remaining spiritually immature, a fact evident from their quarreling with each other. We think of 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Francis Pieper nicely summarizes the New Testament doctrine concerning sanctification. While justification is always perfect, admitting of no degrees, our sanctification in this life will remain imperfect, sometimes showing a minus, sometimes a plus, but never reaching perfection. Scripture admonishes us to grow, increase, abound in sanctification. There are admonitions to grow in holiness. It is clear that the sanctification of even the most earnest Christians remains imperfect in this life. The sarx, flesh, remains in Christians throughout this life. Pieper goes on to state that pastors must give attention not only to the quality but also to the quantity of the works performed by Christians. He notes that the scriptures teach that there are degrees of glory in heaven corresponding to the differences of work and fidelity here on earth. And then he also points out that with regard to unbelievers, there are also degrees, so to speak, in wickedness. And he points this out, referring to the passage Matthew 11, 22, "It shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you." Moreover, when our Qumran passage gives a list, so to speak, of the good fruits of the spirit of truth and a corresponding list of the bad fruits of the spirit of perversity, we are reminded of very similar lists found in the epistles of Paul. We think, for example, of Galatians chapter 5, verses 19 through 23. Further, while the New Testament does not teach that God has predestined some to be ungodly and that he has foreordained evil works, it does, of course, teach that God has elected some to be godly and he has foreordained their good works. They have been called according to his purpose, to use the language of 1 QS 3:16. Other elements in our passage are either taught by the New Testament or are very close to New Testament doctrine. For example, the two categories of men, the sons of light or the sons of righteousness, and the sons of darkness or the sons of perversity, are each in a kingdom, 3:20 to 21. One kingdom is ruled by the Prince of Lights, whom the Qumran sectaries may have identified with the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament or the archangel Michael, whom Daniel 12 describes as the great prince who stands guard over the people of God. The other kingdom is ruled by the angel of darkness, namely Satan. This angel of darkness, who hates the sons of righteousness, causes them to sin and to experience affliction. Satan is aided in his warfare against the sons of righteousness by all his evil angels. But God and his angel of truth are a help for all the sons of light. There will be a final visitation of God. All evil will be wiped out. There will be no more spirit of perversity. There will be a perfecting of the sons of righteousness, who will be given greater knowledge and wisdom. There will be a making new, and the godly will be glorified. Thus, our passage is a sophisticated, complex doctrinal treatise containing teachings either similar or identical to those of the New Testament. Concerning a godly man, our passage teaches that God predestined him for godliness and good works, that he is in the kingdom of God rather than in the kingdom of Satan, that nevertheless the devil and his angels caused the godly man to sin, that the godly man himself has two parts, good and evil. The good part produces good thoughts, words, and deeds. The opposite is produced by the evil part. Despite the sins he commits, this man can be characterized as having a godly disposition, as being a son of righteousness. When we remember that the Old Testament was the sacred book of the Qumran sectaries and their source of doctrine, we really are not surprised at the teachings found in our passage. And our time is running out, so I have to really abbreviate my remarks here, treating only a few passages in the Old Testament. Talking about Satan, we have this revealed already in Genesis 3. Subsequent portions of the Old Testament, the book of Job, 1 Chronicles 21:1, Satan inciting David. Zechariah 3, where Satan is opposed by the angel of the Lord. Again, the author of our passage may have had this angel of the Lord mentioned several times in the Old Testament in mind when he wrote about the Prince of Lights, also called the Angel of Truth, or he may have had in mind the Archangel Michael, or he may have identified the two. There are two classes of humanity taught in the Old Testament, one godly, the other ungodly. We think of Psalm 1. Attached to both classes are the concepts of light and darkness, truth and falsehood in several passages. As concerning our passage's doctrine of predestination, we saw that it was partly correct, partly incorrect. This election to godliness and good works, correct. We think there of Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, where God says to the prophets, I formed you in the womb. Before I did that, I knew you. And before you were born, I appointed you to be a prophet. And probably our author was thinking also of God's total control of everything, which led him then to also postulate incorrectly predestination for wickedness. The use of the word spirit to designate spiritual disposition comes from numerous Old Testament passages. I think of one here, just to cite one, Ezekiel 36, 24 to 26. God promises the Israelites, I will gather you from all the lands and bring you into your own land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you and you will be clean. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. Finally, what about the concept of the two spirits in our passage? We have seen that the teaching does resemble the basic concept of the Pauline flesh-spirit formulations. This two-spirit doctrine, as applied to the believer, simply reflects a theme repeated throughout the Old Testament, that God's people at the same time are saints and sinners. This paper concludes with four brief observations. Number one, since the discovery, translation, and publication of Qumran scrolls, similarities have been noted especially between the Qumran writings and the Johannine literature of the New Testament. Included among these similarities are dualistic concepts, for example, light and darkness, truth and error, some of these concepts being present in our passage. Because of these similarities, many scholars today would agree with Frank Cross, who wrote back in 1961, "It now turns out that John has its strongest affinities not with the Greek world or Philonic Judaism, but with Palestinian Judaism, so that rather than being the most Hellenistic of the Gospels, John now proves to be in some ways the most Jewish." Raymond Brown has this noteworthy comment: "The resemblances do not seem to indicate immediate relationship, however, as if St. John were himself a sectarian or were personally familiar with the Qumran literature. Rather, they indicate a more general acquaintance with the thought and style of expression that we have found in the Qumran literature." Certainly, the Qumran literature, including our passage, is strong evidence against dating John past the first century AD. Number two, our passage reminds us that the New Testament does not present startlingly new doctrines, but builds upon what is already contained in the Old Testament. Sometimes the Old Testament teaches a doctrine in clear form, whereas the presentation of another doctrine may not be as explicit. Nevertheless, the less explicit doctrine does exist in the Old Testament and may be derived by sanctified reason. Three, our passage, particularly with regard to his teaching about predestination and the two spirits, reminds us how fortunate we are to have the New Testament, which always correctly presents a doctrine with no error and at times gives us further elaboration and more detail concerning a doctrine than the Old Testament. And finally, number four, we feel sympathy for the Qumran sectaries, pious men and ardent students of the Hebrew Bible, who nevertheless, in certain areas of their teaching, did not quite reach a fully correct formulation of biblical doctrine. The phrase would be close, but not quite. I am thinking not only, for example, of our passage's instruction concerning predestination and the two spirits, but also about the Qumran portrayal of the Messiah, as presented by Dr. Wenthe. At least one can say they did not have a clear, systematic picture of the Messiah. Only because of God's grace do we have proper interpretation of his inerrant word, both the Old and the New Testament, and thus true doctrine, including a clear understanding of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Thank you for your attention.